I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, so many of us found ourselves looking at the places we visit in our daily lives and asking ourselves a new question. Will going there make me more or less likely to become sick? From elevators and office buildings to supermarkets and restaurants, people began weighing decisions around factors like ventilation and the ability to social distance. For most of us, it was a completely new way of looking at our world. Now, why am I telling you this? Because now more than ever, it's clear that the buildings we use every day are about more than style and structure. Their design affects our health, how we interact with one another, and ultimately what we value as a society. Today, I'm so grateful to be joined by someone who spent his life thinking about these questions and trying to answer them in a way that promotes healing, equality, and dignity. Michael Murphy is the founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group, one of the most innovative architecture and design collectives working today. From hospitals and schools in some of the most remote places on Earth to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, his work has changed the way the world looks at design. I've had the chance to work with him many times through the Clinton Global Initiative and to see some of his projects firsthand, including Central Africa's first comprehensive cancer hospital, the Butaro Center for Excellence in rural Rwanda. Michael's new book, The Architecture of Health, examines the history of hospitals and the simple ways they can be built better today to control disease and promote healing. So, Michael, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's an honor to be here with you.
Let's start at the beginning. How did you realize that this design work was your calling, both in becoming an architect and also the specific kind of work that Mass Design Group does?
Yeah, the beginning is a powerful moment for me and is meaningful today. You know, the beginning of the work really started with my introduction to Dr. Paul Farmer, who we lost
yesterday.
It's a hard loss for us all. I was a young student of architecture, and I think, you know, like many students, was wondering how our work had meaning and what his purpose was, and was learning all around about the work around the world and famous architects and influential architects. But questions of architecture's purpose and who it served and who deserved it were sort of lingering out there until I met Paul. And I met him at a lecture. He was giving a lecture on World AIDS Day, December 1st, 2006, actually. And instead of talking about all the incredible work that he and your organization were doing to provide antiretrovirals to communities that never had them, to lower the price of those drugs, to serve so many more communities around the world and really fight the epidemic, he was talking about systems design and buildings, talking about clinics and hospitals and schools and housing that they were building under a program that Partners in Health, Paul's organization, started called the POSER program, the Program on Social and Economic Rights. And I tell you, it shook my world. I thought, you know, here's this visionary doctor talking about architecture, but calling it healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd never thought of it framed that way or heard it framed so persuasively that way. And then I went up to him afterwards, like so many students did, and waited for him to talk to every single person in the room, as he often did, and said, "Hey, I'm a student of architecture. Who are the architects you're working with? Who's building these houses, these clinics?" And he said, "Funny you should ask, you know, none of the architects have ever seen how they can help serve us. We end up having to do it ourselves. What could you do to help bring architects to rural Haiti, to rural Rwanda and serve our organization instead of waiting for us to ask you how you can be of help?" It's kind of an amazing call to action. You know, he gave me his email. I sent him an email later that night. He got right back to me, as he often does. And 8 months later, I was working with his organization in Rwanda, thinking about what it means to be in service of their organization and what it means to build healthcare that's truly, you know, healing and dignifying.
Well, first of all, since you mentioned Paul, I think that I should tell our listeners, if you don't know who Paul Farmer is, he died suddenly on the job in Rwanda near Butaro, where the University of Global Health Equity is and where this wonderful hospital and what was Central Africa's first cancer center was built with the leadership of Michael Murphy and the Mass Design Group. He also was a man with a million followers. Chelsea has been a devotee, an acolyte of Paul Farmer since she was in Stanford, and he's become a very, very close friend of mine, and just like everybody else who really knew him, we loved him very much. So yesterday was one of the toughest days that my family's had in a long, long time. I decided we should go forward with this program today because Michael feels the same way, and Paul inspired his work. And I know that if he were a little bird sitting on my shoulder, he'd say, "Okay, that's enough of that. Let's go to work." What are we going to do? Anyway, that's the backdrop. If you're interested in Paul Farmer, you should look up one of his many great books or read Tracy Kidder's account of his life. He's the only guy you will ever run across, I think, who graduated from Harvard Medical School but grew up in a bus that was converted for he and his five siblings. His mom was a teacher. His dad was a traveling salesman, and they were rich in love and books, and he made it into an astonishing life. So let's go back to you. You founded Mass Design, which stands for Model of Architecture Serving Society, because you believe that architecture has a critical role in driving social change. So for people who've never thought of architecture this way, give us some examples of how architecture can solve social problems and make our society healthier and safer and bring us closer together.
You know, I do think that question of how does architecture serve us and serve our public better is also about reflecting where it hasn't fully lived up to its potential as well. And we learned this in Rwanda. We learned most specifically about how buildings are actually are making us healthier or sometimes making us sicker. We learned that on the hilltop in Bataro where Dr. Farmer passed away and where our first project was. Because at that time in 2006 and 7, as you know, with your work, the epidemic then was multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, a disease that was being transmitted primarily in hallways of rural clinics of patients with some drug resistance, transmitting through coughing in the hallway to other patients, and then patients coming out with this extremely drug-resistant strand. And that was a design flaw. That was a hallway which wasn't designed for enough airflow. Here is a place that makes you sicker, but could be designed very quickly to make us healthier, to protect us. That simple lesson that if you turn the hallways on the outside, you design the building around airflow, you made it a thinner building so that more air movement could go through it. Simple lessons turn out to be very prescient to what we're going through today. You know, all of us are looking around. I mean, all 8 billion of us around the world are simultaneously going through this, I would say, shared spatial awakening that the buildings around us are threatening us and also wondering how they could make us healthier.
First of all, to give our listeners a little more context, Bataro is a beautiful little place high in the mountains of northeast Rwanda near the Ugandan border. And because it's very steep, the angles of the building had to reflect that. And what started out as people thinking about a treatment center for primarily TB actually became a focus for how you could design a hospital so that it was a healthy place, not a place that made people more likely to get sick from tuberculosis.
Rwanda, it's like one of the most beautiful places in the world, as you know. It's called the Land of 1,000 Hills. It's rolling, beautiful, lush, farmed hills all over this very small country, but very populous country. And this district, as you said, Mr. President, is on the border of Uganda. But it's also one of the least served in terms of medical infrastructure. So it was around 400,000 people in this district and no tertiary care medical facilities. So the government, with the support of Partners in Health and the Clinton Foundation or CHAI, prioritized this district as the place to invest in a new hospital. When you drive there, you pass these majestic lakes nestled into these hillsides with these backdrops of the Virunga mountain chain. It is one of the most beautiful things I've certainly ever seen in the world. And at the top of a hill was a clinic. It was really just an outpatient clinic. And those clinics looked the same all over the countryside. They were the same design. It was basically an open room with beds along the perimeter, you know, beds looking at other beds, a central hallway down the middle. And even though that room might have been designed to hold, let's say, 26 beds or 26 patients in beds, what you saw when you walked into them were 2 patients to a bed, sometimes a patient under the bed, not 26 beds, but 50 beds, all filling the entire room and the hallway. You saw an overcrowded environment, which was increasingly dangerous, especially if you have something like an airborne disease like tuberculosis. So there was a design flaw in that, which was, how do we keep these rooms from being overfilled? Can we change the orientation of the beds? Can we give the patients a different experience and try to protect against overcrowding or overfilling? So one of the designs of the wards came from some studies that we looked at that showed that patients got healthier if they had a view of the outdoors. They took less pain medication. They recovered more quickly if they just had a view of a window, a kind of incredible study from the early 80s. And then also research into the work of Florence Nightingale and others who thought about the ward design as something to make sure that it wasn't overfilled and could be an appropriate place for the medical staff to make sure that they're seeing all the patients at once and can protect them. So we changed the orientation of the bed around a central wall that was sort of half height. Each of the beds looks out. So instead of a central hallway, there's 2 hallways on the edge between the window and the bed foot. And that allowed us to kind of have a slightly more rigid floor plan. So you couldn't fill more beds into the ward and try to protect against overcrowding. The subtle adjustments like that help the care program, you know, help the nurses and staff for saying, hey, this is now an overcrowding problem. We need to create a new ward or have a temporary ward, or we need to use other spaces and never to overfill it and trigger this other injury, you know, infectious disease transmission. To that second point, we started to study how disease was transmitted in the airborne route. And we found from the WHO that 12 air changes per hour, which means the volume of the air in the room is transferred every hour. And if you do it 12 times, it's enough air movement to basically reduce infectious disease transmission. And you can do that if you have enough open windows, enough air movement, if you have a big enough room that has air moving in the kind of upper story. So we implemented that there on that hilltop. And I think really learned about how the building is like a living thing. You know, it's not this fixed object. It's a performative living part of the care program, of the healthcare delivery program. And if we treated it like that, if we paid for it that way, if we designed it that way as a system, we might actually have better performing infrastructure serving more people around the world.
Your new book, The Architecture of Health, talks about all this. And I found it fascinating. It's not just a book for other architects and designers. It's a book that will tell us how in an increasingly crowded world we can navigate both peril and promise. Tell us a little about how you came to write this book.
We were working with doctors, so they were telling us, you know, prove to me that these designs are going to improve the health of our patients. You know, show us through evidence. We had to look at a time when buildings were designed around their climate and their microclimate. They were designed specifically around the places they were in, the environments they were in, the cities they were in. And that was, of course, the case of all buildings until the introduction of, you know, widespread mechanical ventilation or the control of indoor air environments through a heating, ventilating, and cooling systems in the mid-century, in the 1950s and 60s. So every building before then has a sort of inherent intelligence. Not every building, but a lot of buildings have an inherent intelligence that they were designed around their climate. You go to New Orleans, you know, you look at the buildings from the 19th century or, you know, mid-19th century, they have really tall ceilings and really tall windows, triple pane windows, and they have these big tall ceilings because air is hot and humid, and you got to get the air into the room, you got to bring it up into the top of the room, you got to ventilate it with a fan, and you got to keep people cool. You go to the Northeast in the United States, where I'm from, upstate New York, the buildings have really small ceilings, the old Huguenot stone buildings in outside of New York City, up north in the Hudson Valley from the 17th century. You know, they're stone buildings with really small, big chimneys and short ceilings because they had to keep them hot and warm in the cold climate. You know, buildings design can tell you about the climate. That all changes in the mid-century when, you know, technological advances allow us to be able to control indoor air climates in a much more comprehensive and a much more sophisticated way. But it also is a sort of a devil's bargain. And now that we are required to have mechanically ventilated spaces everywhere we go, it's increasing carbon offsets into the climate itself. It's making us more and more reliant on buildings that are mechanically run, and it loses some of the inherent intelligence of buildings themselves. So we learned that on that hilltop because we didn't have the money to pay for a big mechanical system, and we had to look backwards and design something that was naturally ventilated. So this book is that journey. It's looking backwards to see where were the design examples that really showed how buildings are directly addressing our health. And turns out so many of them are hospitals, because the hospitals are designed with that healthcare outcome in mind. So they give us a kind of roadmap, you know, a roadmap for how we might emerge out of this pandemic and think again or think differently about how we might design the buildings around us to serve us better.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting that because of the financial constraints, we might actually wind up designing healthier buildings.
Yeah, one of the lessons Paul always taught us is that resource limitation creates incredible resourcefulness, you know. And in that condition where we didn't have access to massive supply chains, you know, Rwanda is still rebuilding from the genocide. We had to make do with what was available locally, which, you know, forced us to think or search out for examples which have universal applicability, which is which, you know, drove us to look at people like Florence Nightingale and her work in the 1850s, look at Alvar Aalto in Finland in the 30s, look at the incredible work of hospital designers for the last century and what they were trying to solve for. And so this book is that kind of, you know, use it as my own research project, but also a sort of defense in some way of why architecture matters so much to our own ability to live a healthy life, keep us protected. So yeah, we're excited about the book. Also, we have a show at the Cooper Hewitt, which I'll plug now, but the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum, which is related to the show, which is how design and designers have responded to epidemics historically and to this epidemic that we're in the middle of. Our world is defined by it in many ways. You know, I think you're a fan of incredible book, Ghost Maps, which—
Steve Johnson's book, The Ghost Map, yeah.
Incredible book, Steve Johnson's book, yeah. And, you know, the story of Jon Snow's map of Soho, his cholera map of Soho in the 1850s. And for the listeners, it's a, you know, it's 1850. Jon Snow is, he's a scientist before really epidemiology emerges. He takes out a map of the Soho district where there was an outbreak of cholera. He makes a tick mark at every household where there's a case. And he sees that there's a concentration of cases around this one part of the street. He goes and looks at that part of the street, and there's a water pump. He takes up the manhole cover and sees that there's a sewage pipe broken and putting basically sewage into the water source. Famously, or, you know, so the story goes, takes off the handle of the water pump, and the epidemic subsides, and hence, cholera is not, let's say, morally born, but is waterborne, I think is one of the great, you know, statements in the book, that the whole way in which we thought about the solution for solving this scourge, you know, cholera was, you know, transforming cities across the world in huge pandemics from the beginning part of the 19th century into the mid part of the 19th century and through up into the end of the 19th century, just completely ravaging cities and countries around the world. And this changed everything. And interestingly enough, an incredible movement of design emerged called the sanitation era, where people's, you know, governments and city plans started to plan their cities around health outcomes, about separating waste and water, about getting air movement into streets and buildings. You know, Central Park and Frederick Law Olmsted is a big part of that movement. Many of our cities in America are driven by those ideals, and they really, in a lot of ways, began with Jon Snow's map, which was this perfect intersection of epidemiology, visualization tools, and design all together. To a large degree, tuberculosis and cholera were solved diseases at the end of the 19th century. You know, we had figured out a way to design our buildings, design our cities to address it. Doesn't mean that it was gone. It was still endemic in certain areas, but we knew how to solve for it and could implement it with enough resources. But that starts to change, and increasingly more and more places start to see cholera. More and more cities are emerging in unique ways, like you're mentioning, Mr. President, which the cities were designed for. Port-au-Prince, I think, is designed for about 400,000 people and has, you know, 3 or 4 million in it. So the density is just completely overwhelming the systems that they have to separate waste and water, very specifically. And old Port-au-Prince does have a wastewater treatment system, has piped waste and water underneath certain streets in the kind of gridded historic city. But it's the new parts of the city, the neighborhoods that have emerged on very, very steep inclines of hills, or this neighborhood called City of God, which was built on the runoff of the big drains that were coming down from the mountains and bringing kind of runoff, like loose ground into the water's edge, kind of extending the beach. 70,000 people live in this largely informal part of the city, which has no piped waste and water infrastructure. So it is a perfect breeding ground for something like cholera to take hold and create the kind of epidemic that we saw. So, you know, when the design request was put out there, we had to ask ourselves, okay, how does the building address that systemic problem? And the most simple answer is, well, if people with cholera are coming to this place, how do we create a building that separates that waste and doesn't recontaminate the ground soil into the city itself and actually collects it, decontaminates it on site, and shows as an example how a building can actually cleanse the water it's collecting, cleanse the waste it's collecting.
One of the things you did was put the water treatment above the ground, right, and then put a grass cover on it.
Correct, yeah.
And you actually made it look like a stylish part of a new sort of design. Talk about that a little bit, because that was key to making the place safe. How did you do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think understanding the problem was the first one. You know, what's not just the issue of contaminated water, but what are the kind of social conditions of the disease. Dr. Bill Popp was bringing patients here. It was a concentration of sick patients. And we knew that we would have a lot of contaminated waste we'd have to deal with. So a big way to deal with that is to actually use one of the lawns, or in that case was a parking lot, and turn it into a grass field that's lifted up, which has the waste that's collected, goes through a series of chambers. Each chamber cleans it a little bit more, 9 chambers in what's called a anaerobic biodigester, that's the technical term. And then it puts the water, that wastewater, back into the ground. So it sort of distributes it back into the ground. And if it's decontaminated at the 9th chamber, that water is totally clean and able to be put back into the groundwater. That's the way in which your septic system works, of course, in your house. You know, it's the same way. It's just a slightly more comprehensive sifting process.
We'll be right back.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
You worked in Liberia, another country that Chai works in, in the aftermath of the Ebola problem. And the outbreak there was deadly, especially in Liberia and Guinea and Sierra Leone. And tell us what you did there and how you dealt with the Ebola health challenge.
At each of these epidemic outbreaks, we find ourselves trying to serve the organizations that are trying to address these things, and infrastructure becomes a key piece of it. You know, each one of these diseases introduces another type of infrastructural solution. So, you know, Ebola, the issue there was physical transmission, touching each other, or any kind of contamination through skin-to-skin contact or, tears or bodily fluids. And so beyond all of the kind of socialization trauma of not being able to take care of your loved ones or touch them or see them, and sometimes all of that really, really horrific outcomes of the Ebola outbreak, it was really a space planning problem as well. How do you create basically cleaned, sanitized zones that were decontaminated, where caregivers could make sure that they could, what's called don and doff, take off their protective equipment and put it back on so they could walk through areas that they knew were safe and then serve the patients, and then other patients weren't infecting the caregivers. If caregivers start getting sick, as we learned with the COVID pandemic, that's sort of the canary in the coal mine, where there's a problem that is systemic and we need to address it. And what we're seeing with Ebola was that the medical infrastructure didn't provide enough isolation, separation, and decontamination spaces so that patients would be protected and caregivers would be protected. So designing a hospital that has really, really carefully thought about each of these threshold spaces where you walk in, you know the contamination level, you're protected, you're not contaminating the space that you just left, you're not contaminating the patients that are in the spaces where they think they're safe. That's a really, really important kind of space planning strategy and something we implemented on a new hospital design for the country. You know, the other lesson I think we learned from that is after these outbreaks, after these emergencies, there's a ton of outpouring of resources and money and care and interest. And that was the case. Billions of dollars were committed to Liberia, to Sierra Leone, a lot of energy, a lot of emergency response. But there isn't always the investment. There's investment in emergency response, but not always in the long-term infrastructure that is going to be necessary to stem the next outbreak or the next crisis. And I thought it was really telling that the Ministry of Health in Liberia said, we want the money for this outbreak, but we also want money for investing in our healthcare system to strengthen that system so that we're protected and prepared for the next one. And they had been thinking about that for a long time. The president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was so visionary, had said early on, before the outbreak, that the health system needs to improve and strengthen in order to protect the country. So I thought they were really ahead of the game, actually, to push back against, the development industry, which would only pay for, emergency Ebola treatment units that would last for a year, and say, that's fine, we need those, but we also need the money for a permanent medical facility. And that was a really powerful outcome. And we've been working on the design of their new central hospital in downtown Monrovia that will bring in all of these lessons from airflow that we learned in Rwanda, waste management we learned in Haiti, and then separation of patients in the treatment of Ebola. So that all of those are intertwined in the design of this new tertiary care facility that's under construction.
I was really thrilled when you started doing that, because when the Ebola outbreak happened in Liberia, the government asked Chai, our health group, to help them deal with it and stay around if we could. And 4 of our people actually never left the country, and they were miraculously, none of them got sick, but a lot of people did. Tell us what you think the implications of what the frontline workers have been through with COVID and what we've learned from that. And is there a way we could design better to deal with such things in the future?
Yeah, you know, thanks for asking that, because I think these lessons, it's, in many ways, we were preparing for this moment for the last decade, all of us together, working in these epidemic moments and trying to figure out what the spaces could do to help address the diseases we're facing. You know, when COVID broke in February 2020, you know, all of us obviously were thinking about what to do, but it was in April March and April, we started getting calls from our partners, folks that we'd worked with in the healthcare industry, saying, how can we immediately support our constituents, our clients, the people we're serving? And one of them was this amazing group called Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, their network of healthcare services for homeless populations and serving really incredibly marginalized groups suffering in a huge way. And they were getting COVID really in a big way first, you know, another kind of canary in the coal mine example. And we got a call from an old friend named John Bukovalis, who was at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital and went ahead of research, amazing guy. And he had moved recently to Mount Sinai Hospital in New York and was leading a lot of their research there. And that was, as some of you may know or may not know, really kind of the epicenter of the outbreak in New York during April, which is really spiking, April 2020. And, you know, John reached out and said, look, you know, caregivers are getting sick. We're getting sick. We don't know where disease is coming from. We don't know fully all about it. We're in the middle of it. Is there anything we can think about spatially that could protect us, to help us? And so we did this very rapid design research project. We attached GoPro cameras to these doctors' heads, and we did some, you know, Zoom-based recordings, and we mapped with them how the hallways, again, of the hospitals were changing. They were getting filled with equipment. Everyone didn't, you know, donning and doffing was happening in different places. And then we did these exercises with doctors to figure out where they perceived the risk of the disease and where they were safe and where they weren't safe. And I mean, I'm talking, we just took plans, like the fire escape maps from the walls, and we had them with crayons draw on those maps, you know, green, yellow, and red. And it was shocking, and also, I mean, not fully surprising, but each map was different. Everyone had a different perception of where there was safe space and where there was contaminated space. And it's really illustrative just to see it together, because you knew that, oh, well, you can work from this. We can visualize, like Jon Snow visualized the cholera epidemic. You can use this visual tool to start to create rules inside the hospital that maybe incrementally would help the caregivers in the middle of the outbreak, just to kind of create clearer lines of delineation between protection and risk. I mean, it's amazing. And they were just, you know, I just say that it's the doctors and the caregivers that were designing the spaces, you know, redesigning it in real time. I think we have the most to learn from about how they're operating within those terrible conditions, and they deserve really all that credit.
More after this.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect.
Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
You also were involved in the design of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. Many people believe it's the most important structure that's been built in the last several years in America. And so tell us a little about that. Tell us what it is and how you got involved in it.
Well, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice is a memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, that was conceived of, imagined, and designed by Brian Stevenson of the incredible Equal Justice Initiative, Just Mercy, just a profoundly visionary and impactful organization and set of thinkers that are, I think, fundamentally changing the narrative around our country's history of racial oppression and terror. I had been a fan, like many people, and I saw an article in the New York Times where he mentioned that their legal work, keep in mind, Brian and his team are lawyers. They're fighting for people who are incarcerated, often unjustly, and trying to get them the services they deserve. And he said, we can't do this work without addressing the history of racial terror in America and starting to change the narrative around our history of racism in America. And he said, I want to mark every site of lynching, the lynching of African-Americans in America, and I want to build a national memorial to those victims, to rise from the ground this hidden history of our country, bring visibility to it, say their names, and recognize that the landscape of how our public spaces around the country are marked and named and who is recognized is not a full and comprehensive list of those who have suffered and died for our freedom. And this is a necessary piece of infrastructure to help heal our nation. So the project is a memorial to the victims of lynching from really the dates are between 1880 and 1950 to a large degree. And it's organized by the counties across the country and the names of those individuals in those counties who were often publicly terrorized and killed. In particular, the post-Reconstruction kind of Jim Crow era before the advent of civil rights movement. I think the memorials that really succeed are the ones that what I would call transmit the intimate and the infinite. They show the totality of the loss, the totality of the crisis in volume. You know, you can see it. It's not just a number on a page or in the newspaper, which is to some degree hard to understand what that is. You know, 4 million, 6 million, 10 million, that's hard to understand. But if you see, you know, 6 million stones in a pile, for example, to commemorate the Jews that were murdered during the Holocaust, that's a huge, enormous thing. that you can spatially experience. When you see the names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and you walk and you see the list of names as a volume, it's hard to ignore. It shows that sense of the infinite. But then you have to move past that and create a link to find that individual name. And the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is very influential to us because that idea of people coming and finding the name of their loved one, their brother or their father, and rubbing a piece of paper with a pencil and taking away that name on a piece of paper and framing that, that kind of memento, that experience I think is really a powerful one. You know, it's one where you're like transcending just the legibility of the wall and you're touching it, you're building it into your deep memory, that experience. It's unforgettable. And then you feel it. You feel the weight of all of those markers above you as the kind of weight of history that we haven't fully uncovered, you know, that we don't fully know. That weight of history, you feel it in your body. And that to me is where architecture is doing necessary things, you know. This is a very Paul Farmer way of thinking about it, but is the question of what can we not accomplish without spatializing it? You know, memorialization is necessary because we need to create a space or a location where we can go and wrestle with, pay tribute, understand, but also create a unique memory in our own selves that we witnessed this history.
So where are you going from here with all this?
I return often to this amazing quote from, you know, Dr. King in his letter from Birmingham Jail, where he talks about the garment of destiny. Whatever affects one affects all, that we're all tied in an inescapable network of mutuality. I love that line. I think buildings are the places where we experience that mutuality. That garment that connects us all is found and forged in the public realm, in the public places that we have to go and choose to go. And if it's the post office or the hospital waiting room, or if it's the school where we attend, those places transform us. You know, I think periods before, I think of the WPA, I think about the New Deal, I think about these moments where we understood that as a country, where we invested not just in the infrastructure that was necessary to survive, but that we invested a sense of dignity and artistry and commitment to the beauty of it as essential, as elemental. And we've done it before. I think we can do it again. I think we could really take that mantle. We ourselves can enact change through our buildings and through the world around us. I think those are the lessons I hope to carry forward.
Thank you, Michael Murphy. Your inspiration and mentor, Paul Farmer, was very proud of you, and I'm very grateful to you. And I can't wait to see what you do next. And I urge all of you who are interested in these things to look up mass design on the internet and read about them and look at the architecture of health. This is very important stuff, but as I hope Michael has persuaded you, it's also a challenge to the modern world that is accessible to us, one that we can make a dent in often without spending enormous amounts of money or bringing in from somewhere else staggering amounts of expertise. It's what they have accomplished at Mass Design is largely a feat of the imagination, the possibility of wonder being made out of things that are at hand and people that are handy. We're all in your debt, and I wish you well. Thank you.
I thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today in the passing of our friend.
Michael and I will begin to sound silly if we don't stop this, but once or twice in a lifetime, you might meet somebody like Paul Farmer, somebody so extraordinary and yet so real. So commanding and yet so human and hilarious that it changes your life forever. And we're dealing with that loss now. A man who was 62 and should have lived 20 years longer or 30 years longer, but who did outlive his own father by 13 years in a family prone to heart disease. He was a social hero, if you will, but he was a wonderful personal friend. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Why Am I Telling You This is a production of iHeartRadio, the Clinton Foundation, and Atwill Media. Our executive producers are Craig Manassian and Will Malnati. Our production team includes Jameson Katsoufis, Tom Galton, Sarah Horowitz, and Jake Young, with production support from Liz Raftery and Josh Farnham. Original music by Watt White. Special thanks to John Sykes, John Davidson, Angel Urena, Corey Gansley, Kevin Thurm, Oscar Flores, and all our dedicated staff and partners at the Clinton Foundation.
Hi, I'm Becca Curtis-Heald, and I'm a deputy director at the Clinton Global Initiative. President Clinton established the Clinton Global Initiative to create a new kind of philanthropic community to address the complex realities of our modern world, where problem-solving required the active partnership of government, business, and civil society. Over the years, our proven model has grown to include action networks that can quickly mobilize in the face of emergencies, whether that's helping Puerto Rico and the Caribbean recover in the wake of Hurricanes Irma and Maria, or advancing an inclusive U.S. economic recovery amid COVID-19. To learn more about this work and see how you can get involved, visit clintonfoundation.org/podcast.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.